I drove up to Greytown and visited John Summers, which was extremely nice. Greytown's really nice. The drive was really nice, but talking to John was awesome. We talked a lot about Ronald Hugh Morrison's The Scarecrow, but we also talked a lot about John Summers' new book, which is called The Mermaid Boy, which is just stunning. Cue and Cry, and he sent me some proofs to have a look through, just to sort of, you know, his background, and I got completely addicted and finished it, and it's magnificent and exciting, and yeah, it's superb. So we do end up talking a lot about that. We talk a lot about story, and the idea of non-fiction story. Yeah, so it was really nice. Went to Greytown, came home, talked to John. Hope you enjoy it. Thank you.
The same week our fowls were stolen, Daphne Moran had her throat cut. Big dunce that I was at school, my essays, if not my spelling, used to be thought quite good, and I was a keen reader, which is probably why I now presume to set myself up as the chronicler of Clynham's Hour in the Limelight. This was certainly the most hectic and the darkest chapter in the whole history of the town, and, just like I've heard said, murder will out, it seems to me that the true story is bursting to be told sooner or later. It may be that I'm biting off more than I can chew and tackling the job, but who, I ask myself, is going to come to light if I do not accept the challenge? Who was more constantly mixed up in every little scene than little me? But nobody. And whose family knew more of any ins and outs than I may have missed myself? In my own family. Echo answers whose.
Okay, so we're sitting in John's room. What do you call this room, John?
The sunroom is what we usually call
it. Yes, it's very nice. I like it a lot. There's sun today as well. It's very cool. And we're just looking at our covers of The Scarecrow. And mine is odd. I'll take a photo and put them up. But that just, it seems wrong, doesn't it, really?
It does. And it's funny, this one is the first edition.
Yeah.
And it's ex-library, it's an ex-library one,
mm-hmm.
And it's from Wellington Public Library, but I noticed it's from the Children's Library.
Holy shit.
So it's stamped here as, yeah, Children's Library.
No.
Which isn't where I'd choose to put it in the library.
No, I was just saying that because like, on mine there's kind of this cartoon girl being stabbed in the top window and... Oh, this funny little man is stealing a chicken. Yeah. It's very... Oh, my God. Yes, it's really odd. Where would you put it in the library?
I don't know. Well, I'd put it Librarian's Choice if I was the librarian.
Me too. It's bloody good, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. The Scarecrow is my favourite novel.
Mm.
And has been since I read it.
Mm. How long ago did you read it for the first time?
I would have read it when I was at high school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think it was part of the curriculum, or do you think it was something you read outside of...
It wasn't when I read it. But then we had a teacher who did set it as a course text, or whatever you call it.
Because I remember there was a real big thing when I was at school where they would look at, what's the word I'm looking for? Adaptations. Like they would often get, like we watched Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet. I had to get a signed letter from the mum and dad. But and I think The Scarecrow started being taught at that stage because there was the film as well.
Yeah.
Which, I can honestly not remember when I first read this book, but I feel like I've never not read it. I have trouble trying to think of a novel that I like more.
Yeah, definitely. Me too. I mean, I think there's no other novel I'd kind of come back to as often as I would The Scarecrow.
Yeah, I'm the same. And I also, it does really feel like one of those, I mean, that's real cliched, but it does feel like one of those sort of nesting dolls where I sort of come back to it and go, oh my god, that's right, that was in it, was that in there, and then I come back and read it again. That's quite wild. What do you think, like, what, I mean, it's really hard to quantify what's amazing about it, but what do you think's amazing about it?
For me, I think there's a couple of things. Probably the thing I like the most about it is the way he describes adolescence.
Yes.
And adolescence on the cusp of, well, not on the cusp of adulthood, but on the kind of learning about the adult world, and the conversations the boys have, that for me is probably the thing I like most about it. The humour, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Which a lot of it comes out of that.
Yeah. And as often, I think, yeah, I wasn't expecting it to be as funny a book as it was. Hey, the cat's here.
Hey, cat.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting it to be as funny a book as it was.
Yeah, I think the humour's funny, and there's quite broad humour in it.
Yeah,
some of it not as successful as in other places. but there's also these quite witty and subtle things in there too, I think. There's a line, a line I really like anyway. It talks about all the things that have happened in the town, and it says something like, you know, there'd now been two murders, and then it says people playing euchre forgot whose deal it was.
Yeah.
As in, that's the effect of all of this.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a little like that first line, the fowl stolen and the throat cut. It's that same, he's constantly reminding us of small town life going on and people's more trivial concerns while all this terrible stuff's happening at the same time.
Because that was one of the things that I really enjoyed about it, probably because I'm dark and horrible, but one of the things I really enjoyed about it was that idea that there is kind of adolescent sexual awakening happening in the same time as there are these attacks happening that are sexual in nature, you know, and it's just, I really loved that idea. You know, novelistically, like, I mean, you know, they're awful, awful events that happen, but the idea that, you know, if we're shaped by our surroundings and the things that are happening, it's really odd to then place, you know, like adolescent love and burgeoning feelings like that in this kind of area, which is kind of weird.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things it does really successfully is show that... there's a line towards the end where he talks about the narrator Nettie says it was as if this beautiful flower now knocked us over, that we discussed all the time, now knocked us over with its stench.
Yeah.
And it's that idea that they've woken up to the adult world as something they've always been kind of curious about and on the edges of, and now they've seen it as quite a terrifying, an awful thing at the same time.
It's really hard. One of the other things that I find hard with this book is to disentangle the sort of personality of Morrison from the book as well. Like, you know, I know we were just looking at that before. Like, someone's gone through in my copy and stuck in, you know, stuff, you know, like articles about the house being, you know, the house being demolished to put in the Kentucky Fried Chicken and, you know, stuff like that. And it's really hard to read it. But I think when I first did read it, I didn't know much about Morrison. I think, I don't know. What do you reckon?
I think less so with this one than the others.
Yeah.
Came a Hot Friday seems like it's very much about the way his youth would have been, or at least how he likes to think it was.
Mm.
And Pallet on the Floor, which is the darkest one, I think, by a country mile, seems to, if you think about that, him writing that quite late in his career and pretty much he'd given up on his writing career.
Yeah.
And it comes through. The Scarecrow, I don't find that as much with The Scarecrow.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of things in there, like music crops up a lot, which... is obviously, you know, he was a musician as well as a writer, and there's some great lines in there that shows how he's always thinking about music. So there's a line, he describes a staircase as being like a cool vibraphone note, and a train, he talks about a train sounding like a blues trumpet, and things like that.
Yeah, it's so good. And like, I just, that whole... I don't know, I guess that's the other thing is that I can never, because of course, you know, the first thing I did when I came to Wellington was drove to Hawera. And and that's a really odd thing as well, is trying to get that out of my head and remind myself that we're in Clynham, that we're not in Hawera.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I find place so huge in here.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I don't know, what, like, yeah. Because there's fire and there's the tower, it is kind of, yeah, I don't know, that place thing's kind of interesting, eh?
Yeah, I love that. I love books that have a really strong sense of place.
Yeah.
And the comparison, you've probably heard that, this how the comparison's been made to his, well, he gets referred to as Taranaki or New Zealand Gothic, and the comparison is made with Southern Gothic writing. And that's one thing that, because of that comparison, that's how I came across those authors. Faulkner and
like Flannery O'Connor and those.
Yeah, things. Carson McCullers.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I thought I read them because I thought, well, they're going to be somehow like Robert Hugh Morrison. but one way that they are a lot like him, I think, is the sense of place, and small town life, and every nuance of that town seems to be in the pages somehow. You know, he really talks about this town as if he talks about the bit where we throw out your fish and chip wrappers and the movie theater and the you know, the music teacher. So it's really layered with all the that sort of information that comes from being really steeped in a place.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, I guess that's the other cliche about him, and the thing that, you know, constantly, I think this is why I felt attracted to him as a writer, was the fact that he didn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, like there was the short trip to Auckland, eh, and then not liking Auckland, and then back to Hawera.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact, and you know, it is that thing that you're talking about, eh? Like how you can make an entire, you know, like by sitting still and looking around, there's kind of opera to be had everywhere, kind of, eh?
Yes. Yeah.
Because I know, like I was just laughing before, that's exactly how I came to Castle McCullers as well. Right. It was like someone said, oh, you know, it's Taranaki Gothic, and I was like, oh, what else is like that? And they were like, oh, this and this and this, you know, it's quite weird. And I think, you know, this kind of always, when you were, it's really interesting because you read some excerpts from The Mermaid Boy and then you read the first paragraph of this just before, and it's really interesting hearing your voice and like your literal voice all over that. And I was just thinking, this idea of being the chronicler of, did I say that right? Chronicler. I got a real sense of that in The Mermaid Boy. Like I got a real sense of that, because there is a very strong sense of place in Mermaid Boy, whether it is Queensland or it's Christchurch or, you know, like there's a real sense. So one of the things I do want to ask you, which is a bit of an, you know, I mean, I don't know how I'd answer this question myself, but at some stage there must have been a decision to make these nonfiction works. Like, I think I don't think I'd be disingenuous in saying that you could have probably changed some things slightly and fobbed it off as a work of short story.
Yeah.
Why were you interested in that play? Like, because that's what I often feel with The Scarecrow as well, is that it's like being reported, you know, there's this part of the contract that makes the book interesting is you're there with an eyewitness who's going through the things. But what do you want to talk a little bit about that decision to write short nonfiction rather than writing short fiction?
Sure, yeah. So probably, imagine it's not uncommon for people who write creative nonfiction as they might have started writing fiction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, now creative nonfiction, there's a lot of discussion about it, but it feels like that hasn't been around for that long.
No.
And I think a lot of people still think that fiction is the what we should all be doing.
Yeah.
So what I'm getting at is I started writing short stories,
mm-hmm.
and with varying degrees of success, and kind of in doing so realized that the stories I wanted to tell were you know, non-fiction were true stories.
Mm.
And that, you know, the story we talked about before, the one set in Queensland, I had written a fiction story based on that. But the non-fiction one, for me, is more interesting and has more kind of nuance, or there's more going on that makes it interesting, and it's more of a different story than the fiction one.
Mm.
And once I realized that and I started to go down that path, that just really set me up in that direction. And occasionally I've thought, oh, it would be really easy if I could just make something up and put it in here. But it's kind of like you work quite hard to keep it non-fiction, and I don't want to change that and lose what you gain from that. Boss man, everything I look at reminds me of a sweet potato, Henry said. The two of us were sitting on the hostel balcony, our laps supporting plates laden with rice and stir-fried vegetables. As usual, we ate watching the street, the asphalt shimmering in the heat, the occasional clapped-out Holden. We watched the Canadians walking to their van, furtively looking about before climbing in to smoke marijuana. Above all this was a perfect Queensland sky, a vast dome lined with crisp, symmetrical clouds. It was at one of these clouds that Henry pointed. There's one, he said. There's another. He was right. That first cloud was a long and gnarled spud. The second, a squat Beauregard. That'll be a grade two, he said, pointing to an especially skinny example. Again, it was unmistakable. Now that he'd mentioned it, I too saw that they really were everywhere. The clouds, the bushes, the rust patches on the Canadian's van. I closed my eyes, but still I saw a few.
Because that's what I really love. Like, I mean, I'm quite obsessed with, I find nonfiction incredibly interesting, and I find that line, because that's, with writing something nonfiction, like when we talk to our students that are doing life writing, what we're often talking about is that you're shaping events rather than inventing, which is such a, I don't know, there's something about that that makes it feel like something more of a high wire act than saying, oh, they need to lose that whatever they're hanging around with, you know, they need to lose that friendship. They need to, you know, whereas when you're working in nonfiction, there's just something so, it just seems like to have a higher degree of difficulty to say, no, these are the boundaries and you can't, you know, you can't operate outside of it. But if you want to elevate, if that feeling was elevated in that moment, you need to find the detail that elevates that feeling
as well.
Because, so did you, when you say you started writing short stories, I'm going back trying to remember, like, we've been in writing group for, would it be 5 years, 6 years, longer maybe?
Probably 6 years.
And like, I always associate you with Hugh and Cry. You were in the Howard special edition as well, right?
Yes.
And you read up at the Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Yes.
That was one of the greatest things ever to happen. But how did you meet Chloe somewhere, or like, I'm trying to think.
Yes, so I met her in Wellington.
Yeah.
Met her in Wellington after I'd come up from Christchurch.
Cool.
And then later, when I moved to Wellington, got in touch with her again, and she'd already told me about Hugh and Cry at that point.
Yeah. So you would go to work, do your job, and then write in the evenings, or how are you finding how are you working writing into your, you know, your university and you know, like, were you writing in university?
I actually did a undergraduate. So the only kind of creative writing, you know, study I've done, I did an undergraduate course at Canterbury.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that was really useful for me. And I was writing short fiction for that. And I wrote, yeah, and actually out of that I wrote the story I was talking about before about the Queensland, working in Queensland. And Yeah, it was through Hugh and Cry I started writing nonfiction.
Yeah, yeah.
I think, and Chloe was really encouraging when I started submitting stuff to Hugh and Cry and what I was doing with nonfiction, and I started to become aware of what other people were doing and what you could do in nonfiction. The other thing I've done for a long time was travel writing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd been doing that since I was in Christchurch.
Yeah.
So I'd write, at the time I was trying to write fiction and then also writing non-fiction travel writing. And I like to think there's a little crossover in that, you talked before about sense of place.
Yeah.
And just, you know, place is obviously really important to travel writing.
I was just thinking about how often I got the it's Sunday and I was looking at that escape part of the Sunday, which just it always makes me cringe because they're always advertising, you know, they're always kind of like, hey, come here, it's amazing, you know, like it's incredible. But I always love the way travel writing has that opportunity to sort of be the anti, you know, like the anti advertising for a place.
Yeah, but unfortunately doesn't often take that opportunity. So some of the travel writing I've done, and I've tried to. So I had a couple of pieces last year about China. And one about like having a terrible time in places. And it's interesting because I sent them off to a travel writing competition, and I saw the judges' comments. They didn't get anywhere, and then I saw the judges' comments, and it said, and some people tried to write about places they didn't enjoy. And it said, never a good move. And I was, so I thought, I'm obviously shouldn't be sending these things off to travel writing competitions. But it was interesting because I thought, surely you just write about a place whether you like, and be honest about it, whether you like it or not.
And like, there's just, I mean, like, some of my favorite travel writing is that way. Like, I was just thinking about the, I can't even remember his name, Knausgård. The new that he's done for the New Yorker, which is kind of like, oh, this place sucks in this place. And I always think about David Foster Wallace's, you know, supposedly fun thing I'll never do again about the cruise ship, which is hilarious. And yeah, I really like it. And it just seems crazy that people would want to stick, because that's what I think frustrates me about the travel writing that gets published in the mainstream, is that, and that's what I think is so great about upcountry, is that there's a sense of play with it all the time, you know what I mean? Yeah. There's a sense of, like, I think Sarah Bainbridge wrote a cool thing about taking children camping and, you know, stuff like that, and like, some of your stuff's been quite witty and funny, and, you know, and I feel like that sense of play isn't often there, is it? Like, nonfiction often is a little bit serious.
I guess so. And for me, and I guess we should take it back to Morrison. but there's something he said, you know, we talked about someone making that comparison with Southern Gothic.
Mm.
And apparently he was interviewed for a radio show, and the guy interviewing him made this comparison with Southern Gothic. And Morrison pretended he knew all about that. And then later, he spoke to Morris Shadbolt, and he said, who are these people? And Morris Shadbolt explained it to him, and Morrison said, oh, do you crack a smile when you read those books? And he said that he only liked to read stuff that made him smile.
Man.
And I kind of... I kind of think a little bit that way too, that I like with the stuff I do, I try to put humour in it in some way, even if it's very slight.
Because that's what I think is so cool about Mermaid and the Mermaid Boy, is that it is a smile, but it's often, I don't know, there's different degrees of smile, I just really like how there are those degrees throughout, you know, like it's kind of like, I don't know, it reads like my favourite comedy TV shows. I'll probably misrepresent it as a comedy book, because it's kind of like Louis C.K. a little bit, it's kind of a little bit like the, you know, the British Office, you know, like it's kind of, there are moments where I'm smiling for sort of like, oh no, and there's moments where I'm smiling thinking humans are great, and then there's moments where I'm smiling thinking life is hard, and I think you've managed to get all of that, and I think it's interesting, that comment, because smiling and entertainment is not something we often regard highly, in literature.
I think if you're honest, and I think that about the travel writing and the stuff I do for Upcountry too, if you're honest about it, I'm honestly not often having very portentous and deep thoughts about something. And that's... So if I go tramping, I know I should be admiring sublime landscapes, but I'm more often than not thinking about, oh, how far do I have to go?
Yeah.
Or what am I going to eat when I get to the hut? And if you write in nonfiction, when I think back about these moments in my life, and perhaps they were really, now I realise, important, or, there was quite a lot going on. But at the time, I wasn't thinking about that, or if I was, I was thinking about it at the same time as I was thinking about very mundane or trivial things, or seeing things in a way that was very much about what I had going on at the time. And, it wasn't the kind of reaction we'd like to think we'd have to things. Real life. It was like playing at real life. That first flat. Gareth, Sam and I, all students, all living there. Henry sleeping on the couch for most of the holidays. We had to go to Pack and Save. We had to pay a phone bill and buy credit for a power manager. We took it upon ourselves to make a batch of tomato sauce. It was the cheapest place we could find, and we revelled in being in a bad neighbourhood. One night, Gareth and I crouched by the front window, listening to two men arguing in a car parked outside. They were burglars dividing their spoils and had come to a stalemate over bedding. "The thing is," one of them said, "it was my idea to take the fucking duvet in the first place."
And I think,
and there's humour that comes through that.
Yeah, and I think that's what I think is one of the really revolutionary things about Mermaid Boy, like reading it, and what feels so fresh and new about it is that nonfiction, like Ingrid Horrocks, I sat on a lecture with her, and she was saying that creative nonfiction, the essay often started as kind of this, like a redemption, narrative. So what it was I lived a bad life, bad stuff happened, I found Jesus, and now I'm a saint, kind of thing, And like often in the nonfiction that I find trickiest is the stuff where there are these massive insights. Do you know what I mean? There are those moments where we look out to the ocean and we see finally that, all is good, And I really like the subtle ways you build narrative in it. I think they're a lot more subtle than, they're a lot more subtle than some of the nonfiction that I find tricky,
Right.
When you said that you started seeing what other people were doing as far as nonfiction goes, can you remember any of the people you read around that time?
It's interesting.
Or are there nonfiction writers you like now? Or because I guess you could just as easily take, that's the interesting thing about nonfiction. Like if you're, often when I'm writing fiction, I read nonfiction or poetry to kind of inject something into my work. And I guess if you're writing nonfiction, you might be reading more fiction perhaps.
I read a bit of both. I've read those Best American Essays for a long
time.
They're
great.
And I really enjoyed those. But I've never, don't feel like I've ever written an essay in that style or form. The other person I've read a lot in because of the travel writing was Paul Theroux.
Oh, great.
And again, the way he describes place is really brilliant. And I also think what he does really well, people say he's horrible and he's horrible about all the places he goes to. And there's a little, there's some truth in that, but I also think he puts it all out there.
Mm.
And we get to laugh at him and think he's a grump or whatever.
Mm.
But he's still, we're lucky that he's
he's
putting that out there. So we know, I'm not quite sure what.
I think, that's what I think as well, is just that idea that, I think, again, it's that, that's that weird thing where I always romanticize about what traveling will be like.
Mm.
And then when I actually go traveling, what tends to happen is most of the time that I'm traveling, I'm thinking, oh, I hate this. I want some decent food, or I want my bed, or why are these people so wacky, and why do I keep upsetting people? And then when I get home, I look back on it and think, oh, that was amazing. Remember that? Oh, it was incredible.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I think is quite cool about him, is that he manages to maintain that difficult, you know, like the sort of, you know, the trickier parts of it, which I think
is really good. Absolutely.
Which I think, you know, again, is kind of, I mean, you know, he better not enter that travel running competition that the day. They would not be happy. Because I guess that was something that I guess happens in The Scarecrow as well. Like, I mean, it's not a great advertisement for small town living, is it?
No.
It's kind of, and, you know, like, I guess, you know, I mean, that's another cliche of Morrison, is the idea that, you know, the people were not happy. You know, Hawera has never found need to sort of, you know, memorialise them. Or is that true, or what do you reckon? like, I mean, the Kentucky Fried Chicken thing, I mean, I don't know. What do you reckon? I don't know.
I don't know about that. I mean, from what I've heard, it sounds like that was the case for a long, long time.
Yeah.
I think it might be changing now.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, I just don't know how you can think that a book about your place could only be positive.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
Although then again, I mean, it is the themes that are in his book. And,
yeah.
I don't know. I kind of like his view. Even though he doesn't romanticize small town life, I've kind of always liked his picture of small town life, and that's one of the things I like about it, about his writing. My dad lives in a small town, and I spent a lot of time there growing up. And when I read The Scarecrow, that was another thing that really resonated for me to see. And suddenly I saw all these Morrison characters everywhere. And the way he talks about kids kind of, you know, coming up with money making schemes and wandering around with nothing to do. That seemed really, really accurate as well.
What am I trying to say? We were just talking about that interesting thing about here, like in Greytown, how people sort of come in for the weekend now, and, you know, like, is small town ever going to be like it was in The Scarecrow again, do you think? Or
I think, especially if you think about Scarecrow, it's about, I don't know how old they are exactly, but, you know, adolescents, I think that would probably still ring true, that there's kind of a sense of boredom and stuff happening elsewhere.
Yeah.
I think there's a bit where he talks about the city in this way, where it's clear that it's where stuff happened. And the way that the friendships, and there's the town gang, and I think there's still elements of that will never change, especially if you're growing up in a smaller place.
Yeah. Because that's, I think I was saying to you before as well, like, you know, I was in Gore last year visiting some friends and that, and it's really interesting sort of talking to people that are teenagers down there and what it's like to grow up in Gore. And it's very, even though, you know, they have a car and they can drive to Invercargill and, oh, the big smoke. But, you know, like, it does feel something, some of that sort of freedom and autonomy and stuff still seems to remain.
Yeah.
And that sort of, I don't know, like, I always had that thing being a city kid that the kids in the small towns were getting up to way more mischief.
Yeah.
Like, because that must have been odd having, because you were sort of in town and out of town, weren't you? Like,
yeah.
And you really capture that in the title story of the book, you know, you really capture that sort of sense of, like, the town south and the country south.
Yeah.
Well, not country, but, you know, small town south, which I think is really cool.
Yeah. And I think one thing with the, I don't know, it seemed to me when I was a kid that when you went into the smaller towns that there was less, I guess because there's fewer, with kids there's fewer of you, so you have to hang out with these people.
Yeah.
And you can't be so picky and factional like in the, I'm sure it's not true for everyone, but like that seemed to me that way anyway.
Yeah. I think that's what's great about that story. Well, what I love about it is that idea that there is someone who perhaps is not meeting the norm, you know, like, and yet, you know, I just love the way the narrator kind of says, oh yeah, but we'll just finish the summer, you know, like, then we might need to cut them loose, but you know, and I really do think that, again, it's there's something interesting about a constrained environment, isn't there? You know, like, that's what I think is so interesting about the Scarecrow, is no one can actually leave, you know, like, it's not like, it almost, I don't know, like, I was just thinking of the structure of it, you know, like, you just need to live with the fact that you've got an Uncle Ethel, and you just need to live, you know, that's just, you can't kind of reinvent yourself, you know, and I don't know, like, the I find that really interesting about the book itself.
Yeah, definitely. I love that the Uncle Ethel and the Undertaker and his dad, like, the main character seems to know that none of it's very satisfactory. But he describes it, he just has to describe it and put up with it, and he passes that on, but he's not very happy about it.
There's I've got an Uncle Ethel, but I think that was another thing I loved about the book. But there is this really, I mean, that role that Neddy takes on as a storyteller, and you know, I think any time I've read, you know, critique of the book, and that, you know, that's one of the things, you know, the idea that he feels kind of above his station a little. Well, not above his station, but he feels he's had literary, you know, there's humour to be had with that. You know, there's something really clever about that, I don't know what you'd call it, but about that kind of literary device, eh? He's a very useful narrator.
Yeah, he's a funny narrator because, and I think people have written about this too, that he's a child, it's supposed to be written when he's an adult and he's looking back, but then it's still to a degree in the child's voice. And it's really strange, and there's a few scenes that he couldn't have been at, and he says at the start, grant me some license, I'm going to, like... So he's not entirely a reliable narrator, and as you say, he's got this thing going on where he thinks he's a little bit superior to everyone else, which also adds to that unreliable narrator aspect to it, and makes it successful, because it makes it more successful, because when he has his, like, realizations and moments, they have more impact because he's a little bit foolish. But he's chosen to make himself foolish in the past. It's quite a strange thing going on.
It's really complex, eh? Because I think that was the other thing about it. Like, when I first read it, I can't remember in what context I was reading it, but it felt... And this is, you know, this is just my mistake. Well, I don't know. You know, this is what it felt like. It felt rollicking in a way that a lot of other stuff I was reading wasn't kind of rollicking and boy's own adventure. And also it felt kind of, it felt like a very old-fashioned way to tell a story. You know, like, I am going to tell you a story now, sweet reader. And I just think, in subsequent readings, I've realized just how complex... You know what I mean? Like, it's an incredibly, I don't know whether other people would say this, but it seems incredibly cleverly paced.
Yeah, very well paced, I think.
And the tension is so well controlled. Yeah. Like, you know, you often I'll be reading and thinking, oh, I want to find out what that is. I want to find out what that is. Oh, I found out, you know, like, and I just think, and the darkness of it is just that play between, you know, hilarity and absolute, you know, horrificness is there's some really good balance there.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's a really interesting, and it was his first novel too. Oh, it's really interesting.
Don't even start.
But yeah, the pace definitely, and it's these, you know, he's a bit shaggy and there's a few bits that are a bit shapeless, but generally I think it's quite I don't know, there doesn't seem to be too much that's extraneous. It moves along fairly well.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think that's Yeah, I don't know. I always feel astounded by it because it seems, and I think this is just me doing this and my lack of understanding about New Zealand literature, but it does seem to sit somewhere so separate from the line of New Zealand literature.
Yeah.
You know, like, I know we've had Gothic writers, you know, again, you know, but there's just something so isolated about it. And I don't know whether, I don't know whether I'm putting that on it because I now know about Ronald Hugh Morrison, or, you know, like, I've, you know, like, visited Hawera a lot, or, but I just can't work out have you got any thoughts on that, or do you think I might be crazy?
I've always thought it was interesting, and I've always thought it seems like other writers of that period or that generation, probably better to say, were interested in establishing a New Zealand voice and New Zealand themes.
Yeah.
And but then it seems with him it's just like he took those for granted and wrote a thriller.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, it seems very confident, and he's you know, really highlighted a lot of, you know, very distinctively New Zealand things.
Mm.
But it seems not self-conscious.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think it does just seem like, and that's what I often think with Pallet on the Floor as well, and Predicament, and, you know, like, it really does. And Came a Hot Friday, which is a really good book. Like, I don't know, like, it was the last one I read, but God, it's, you know what I mean? Like, it's got its problems. It's got humongous problems in it. But I just think there did seem to be this, I don't know, and, like, again, this is me, you know, legendizing. That's not a word. I don't know what you call it, but the idea that it feels like writing with no one watching.
Yeah, yeah.
And that I think is something I always think about with him, is that, you know, like, and the fact that, you know, I don't know if he was writing with a view to publication, or, you know, like, but that idea of writing with no one watching seems to work really, I don't know. It just, there is something about it that feels very, like you say, very confident.
Yeah, and he brings in pop culture, and which I don't know, maybe I haven't read widely enough, but I don't see that in books from that time as much. Like, you know, because invariably it's American pop culture references.
Yeah.
So it feels like we're being let in on something.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit like, you know, a snapshot as opposed to a staged photo to a degree. So that we're seeing, you know, a different side of New Zealand.
Yeah. Because also it feels like it's not trying to elevate New Zealand. I don't know, that sounds really wanky, but you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't feel like it needs, it's a book that's trying to say, this is exceptionally important, you know, like, and yeah, I don't know. Oh God, I don't even know where I'm going with that. But
it's like, it's not the great New Zealand novel, and for me, that makes it more enjoyable.
Yeah, and I think that's what I find so strange, is that because it wasn't trying to be the great New Zealand novel, it feels like the great New Zealand novel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which just seems ridiculous.
Yeah.
It seems ridiculous. I, going back to narration and Nettie, and, you know, where Nettie's placed in time in this book, I want to go back to your book. Sorry, we keep circling back because it just keeps making me think of things. But you're, like, that's the thing with nonfiction, is that, you know, that idea of reflection, you know, like, and most of the stories are written about a time that's a while ago, eh? There's a couple that are closer, or?
There's one that's about the time I spent living in China, which is a year ago now.
Yeah. Because I think, do you feel any different writing about a year ago to writing about, you know, university times, or with the Mermaid Boy when you're at primary school? That was primary school, eh? Or high school?
Primary school.
So, like, does it feel different in your head? Does it look different in your head? You know, though.
Yeah, I think one thing I find is that memory really helps you to shape a narrative, and memory does a funny thing of bringing things back to you in a little self-contained, you know, quite self-contained and in a narrative form already. So it's harder for me to write about things that are more recent to see what the narrative is there. But then on the other side to that is you don't have access to as much detail because you just can't remember as much. And yeah, things are a little, of course, they're just a little hazier. And yeah, so that's, it was interesting for this book, writing about stuff that was more recent. And yeah, it was good. I enjoyed doing that. But before that, I'd always written about stuff that was happened for long, you know.
This is one of my current obsessions. You've kind of blown my mind a little bit. Like this idea of, you know, the payoff for writing now is bigger details than the payoff for writing past is. Because I think, I don't know if this is true, and I keep saying it, so I'm making it true, but my understanding is that memories are actually, we have to keep working to keep memories, you know, like, and that's why they get into that form.
I also do a thing where I tell stories a lot. So when I talk to friends, a lot of these, they would have, and definitely Elisa would have heard these stories before they saw them written. And that's a funny thing to do in working out what the story is and what's important about it.
Yeah.
And the stories like The Mermaid Boy, I would have told it, I'm sure, just like, well, here's a funny thing that happened.
Yeah.
And then as I think more and more about it and told it more often, I've thought, well, what was going on there? And writing it down is a really helpful way of figuring that out and realizing what, you know, his story, but also mine and what where I was and who I was at that time.
Yeah. Because that's, I think that's one of the really interesting things about nonfiction is that it seems to turn back on ourselves. You know, it seems to be about us and not about us at the same time. Like, obviously, you know, this is a thing that we practice all the time. And, you know, when I teach life writing is, you know, this, the narrator that is in your book is a version of you. You know, it is not you. And, yeah, I think you're right. I think this idea of sort of, like, often that question's really interesting to ask when you're writing nonfiction, isn't it? It's like, who am I in relation to this person?
And, yeah.
You know, like, who am I in relation to... Like, there's that magnificent scene in the opening story where the kid that the narrator's been buying a pie off, you know, like, lots of pies, and he says, oh, we're off now, and the boy from the dairy's like, oh, okay, you know, like, I didn't even know you were around, you know?
Yeah,
and
I
just think these sorts of observations are so interesting, especially when they're brought into a nonfiction.
Yeah. Yeah, that was an interesting one because for me it was kind of at the time even deciding like this is important stuff, this is our first flat, this is, you know, that guy from the dairy is going to miss us when we leave. But of course it's, you know, how I can see that differently again and that becomes a little ironic, I guess.
Yeah.
With time.
So do you place, like, if Nettie is in the future looking back on the summer, do you, can you talk a little bit about the narrative you, you know, can you talk a little bit about, or is that just crazy?
I have thought about that a bit, and I think it's different for each story. For most of them I think it is a little like Morrison's narrator in The Scarecrow, and that he shouldn't, even though it's non-fiction and it's me, I'm not that reliable a narrator. You know, I'm not writing those sorts of pieces where I say, here's something that's really important and here's why. It's more telling the story, and it's hopefully, it's revealing to the reader why it's important as it's being revealed to the narrator. And I think that's kind of what he's doing in The Scarecrow, in making Nettie, even though he's in the future, he's not entirely, you know, he's a little self-important and a little foolish, so that he can then be shown to be wrong and have stuff revealed to him. And I try to do that a little myself, because I just think it makes the story more interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Because that, I really loved what you said about telling stories, because I think that's one of the things that, with The Scarecrow, that felt tricky for me, coming from, you know, I'm just trying to think. I'm sure around it I was reading all these quite modernist books where, you know, the narrator disappears and,
yeah,
you know, like all that sort of thing. And this very self-conscious idea that I need to tell you the story. I'm the one that's going to have to tell you because I'm the only one that has access to all the information. You know,
right.
I'm also, you know, quite good. My essays were quite good. You know, that sort of thing. And I just think, I just think that I love this idea that you're talking about telling a story first, you know, because I totally agree. You know, like, I think often listening to myself and listening to which of the stories are the stories that I retell, you know, and what do I think I'm telling when I'm telling that story?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because what was it like revising? Like,
Really hard.
Yeah.
There were a few that I didn't feel like I needed much revision, but
mm-hmm.
there were a lot that were really hard. And generally, I kind of write stuff quite short and then make it longer and longer.
Mm-hmm.
And what that usually involves is adding more of me to it.
Yeah.
And it's that thing again that when I tell a story to other people, it's not usually so much about myself.
Mm.
And then as I sit down to write it, I realize how much I was involved in that, and
yeah.
how you know, and add that detail in and context and place and everything.
Man, it just sounds like an incredible process. And you've been working with Laurie editing it.
Yeah,
Laurie Patchett.
Yeah,
what's that been like? I'm always interested in that editor writer sort of thing.
Yeah, it's been great. I mean, Laurie's a great editor, and I really enjoyed working with him on it.
Mm.
I feel like he sees, he understands what I'm trying to do, but sees things that I wish I knew. Like, yeah, like, it's hard to explain, but I feel like he's finding stuff I didn't know was there and all of that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Because I think that's what, that's one of the great things about us having had the writing group for so long, is that I feel your work is, like, some of the work that just resonated with me right from the start, and I felt excited about it from the start. But to have read it and kind of like you say, to become such a fan and to then sort of think, oh yeah, I read it this way, and therefore what I've got to say about it's really important, because you know. But I just think that's one of the great. That's what I think is one of the, you know, having read the proofs, you know, that's what I think is one of the great things in there, is that Laurie, you know, is a huge fan, and you can kind of, you know what I mean, like, to have that as an editor is huge. Like, to have someone, like you say, who knows the work, is quite an educated reader of the work as well. Because I feel just that weird thing that I feel like you've kind of trained us to read the work in a way. Do you know what I mean? Like, not like boot camp training.
Yeah, I should train more people to like it, I think. It's just really, I think I'm just really lucky to have Laurie, to be working with Laurie on it.
Yeah.
Know? And he's such a great writer himself. And when I went to, a lot of these I wrote when I was in China, and I couldn't take many books with me. And the only books I could get hold of at the school library were from the Foreign Languages Press. And they were all, they were books that were on newsprint and had these blurbs that said how they were critical of capitalism.
Oh.
So that was like Oliver Twist and Sister Carrie. It was quite a weird selection. But anyway, what I was trying to, what I was going to say is, so, you know, I could only take a few, and Laurie's book was one of the ones I took, just because I knew I was going to be doing a lot of writing, and it was a really useful book for what he does with narrative and the way he tells stories.
Because I think that is one of the real successes of, you know, Mermaid Boy, is that there is that. And I think that's that thing with nonfiction, you know, like, you've managed to shape them into these very nice stories. And I think it's probably, like you say, from that, you know, telling the story. And, you know, like, I just think, is narrative important to you? Like, when you read, do you, what am I trying to say? Like, are you interested in how things hold together?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, me too.
Although, I don't know if, I think I read for it not self-consciously often. So, books that don't have a strong narrative, I'm less drawn to.
Mm.
Yeah, without quite realizing it, perhaps.
Because that's what I think, you know, like I always think about how I kind of want to be one of those people that, you know, love style. Like, I always have this thing where I just want to be one of those people. And then I just realize that all my favorite books, you know, like what they've really got is structure, and they've really got, you know, like they hold things together, and they give you the right amount of information at the right time, and you know, like you experience that kind of tension with them, and yeah, it's quite incredible. It's really incredible. What else should we say about Morrison? How would you? There are people that haven't read it, I'm sure.
Yeah, I don't think there's as many.
No.
Like, it's said to be this kind of secret, or, you know, that he, you know, unheard of, but I don't think that's true anymore. I think it's as well known as any New Zealand novel, maybe probably more so because of the films.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, goes back to that thing we were saying before, that it's, he, because he was writing without, what was your phrase? Writing.
Can't remember. Like no one was looking.
Yeah, like
that
no
sounds
one
like
was
a
looking.
Beer commercial. I think I've invented a beer commercial.
Yeah, well, that's appropriate for him, I guess. But yeah, I think that's just made it a really successful, popular book.
Yeah, because that was one thing I did want to talk about a little bit with your writing, is there's a lot of work in it. You know, like there's a lot of making money. And you worked hard. Also, there's a lot of work in it as well.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It doesn't read like something that's been laboured over. But there's a lot of, you know, like there's a lot of the nuts and bolts of living.
Yeah.
Which I think, I don't know, I really enjoyed that part of it. And it's hard to find sometimes.
Yeah, so it's funny because I always watch movies and stuff and I'm like, how are they making it? How are they paying for all of this? Like, And even books too, they're always doing this. But books are always doing this. But you know, a lot of books, maybe not a lot, but I feel like I've read books where it's like they, you know, as soon as work happens it glosses over until the event happens.
Yeah.
And I think that stuff's important, and it's so much of how we spend our time, and affects everything else around you. You know, you can't not describe it to some degree.
And yeah. I think as well is that it's so rife for character development as well, isn't it? Like, I mean, you know, to force people into, like, I've always got this thing that I feel like we're only not living in murderous anarchy because, you know, everybody just doesn't want to look stupid.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And I think work has all these weird things where it's like, you know, like, I don't know, like, I've worked a couple of papers with places where people have just said, fuck this job, I'm leaving, and walked out.
Mm.
And I remember thinking, wow, you can do that.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I think that work is such an odd thing that we do.
Mm.
And it takes up so, like you say, it takes up so much of our time. Everything else is kind of, every other decision often has to fit into it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because that's what I really like about that opening story as well, is that, you know, the university essay is still there, the, you know what I mean? Like, there's still, you know, someone's working in the supermarket, I think, and, you know, like, there's just, it just feels right to have work there. I totally agree. I hate it. Like, I was watching, because that's what got me excited about Girls. Like, I was really excited that Girls was going to be about making money, because in the first episode, they sort of cut her off, and I was like, oh, she's going to have to make money now, but then she got rich again. And, like, those people in Friends.
Yeah, exactly. That's the obvious one. Eh? People, I was always a Seinfeld fan rather than Friends fan.
Yeah, yeah.
And part of the reason is because you saw George at work.
Yeah.
And
and there were those great episodes with I've forgotten her name now.
Elaine
at work. Like
the
episode where she gave her boss a bra and the boss wore it on the outside. And I mean, there was just all this great kind of comedy of errors kind of opportunity in work. And,
yeah, absolutely.
And it drives me, and I'm reading a book at the moment which I'm loving, but there's this real problem in it where everyone's so rich they don't work.
Right.
And I'm just like, oh man, I want to see what you're like when you have to work, you know.
Yeah, because most of us, you know, most of the jobs we do aren't, you know, they're not the exact thing we would choose to do if we had the choice.
If we had 8 hours a day.
Hours is so long too. And I just I think it's a start. Yeah, it's been a starting point for a few things for me, just because it's so interesting. And when you're a student, you do all these jobs you have no background for or interest in. Or...
And they're really hard jobs. That's the thing that always gets me, is that the jobs that you can get, like, are really hard. Like, I think probably if you took a university student and made them a CEO, they'd probably be all right. But you know what I mean? But I mean, when it comes to planting stuff or working in a factory or cleaning stuff, those are quite hard jobs.
Yeah, yeah. And you suddenly interacting with people you have, you know, completely different people to whom you interact with during the rest of the week.
Yeah, it's just, it's really, yeah, I just, yeah, I really enjoyed that about the book. How long since you've lived in Christchurch?
I think. Sweet. I moved to Wellington.
So what's, like, the book does have a bit of Christchurch in it.
Yeah.
How does it feel writing, like, I mean, that's, I guess, I don't know, the earthquake.
Yeah.
Wait, how, like, how does that feel? I don't know. It's, I think it's, yeah, I don't know. Do you want to talk about that?
It's funny because Christchurch, it's a funny thing, and I guess it's not where the Christchurch now, it's not, I don't know how to say this, but, you know, Christchurch is all, because it's been 8 years and since I've lived there, and, you know, Wellington and now Greytown is home pretty much for me. And Christchurch seems, you know, of course it's so different now because of the earthquake, but then it was already becoming quite distant for me.
Yeah.
Because I was already thinking about a different Christchurch anyway.
Yeah. I love that idea of ghosts, you know, that idea that different versions of town sit there. Because, like, there in the opening story, those guys are living out east, eh?
Yes.
Yeah. And just, I don't know, like, I just love the fact that that Christchurch is kind of layered on top of the real Christchurch at that time, whatever that is.
Yeah.
But, you know, and then that Christchurch is also layered on top of, you know, the Christchurch as it is now,
yeah,
the Christchurch it will be, and all that sort of thing. Because place, like, I mean, that's the way, oh God, this will set us off on everything, but, like, that idea of capital T truth, you know, that idea of the true sort of thing. And there is that weird contract that when you read something that says it's nonfiction, there's, I just think that is what I think excites me about nonfiction so much, is there's that liminal space where you're like, it really happened, but really is a really contentious kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, it's been interesting for me deciding, you know, it's not reportage.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not, you know, an eyewitness account. It is, they are stories. They're non-fiction, but they are stories. And so that means, you know, they're works of memory. I haven't...
Yeah.
Gone, there's the odd thing, but for the most part I haven't gone back and tried to research to make sure I've got a very accurate version, because for me the memory is the most, you know, that's the version I've lived with, that's the version I want to tell.
Oh man, I just love that sort of stuff. Like, I just think, and I just think it's that weird thing where they just, like, this idea of them being stories and non, there's just something so wonderful about that, the energy that happens between those two concepts.
Yeah, like, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I was just thinking, like, the other day we were watching The Americans, which is a program about spies in America.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In the 1980s. But apparently the guys that write that went back and looked at TV guides to make sure that everyone was watching the right TV show on the right day. And I was just thinking, there's that weird thing, isn't there, where... Like, I mean, does that make that truer? Or, you know, like, it's just, you know, I just love this idea of, like you say, like, it just brings up that idea of personal truth and perspective and memory truth and, it's just so great.
It's funny. That reminds me, I always feel like when I was a kid that Fleetwood Mac was always on the radio.
Yeah, I think it was.
But I, you know, but they would have, it wasn't quite the right time for them, but I guess they were just on, this is in the... early mid 80s. But I guess they were just played on the radio constantly from whenever that album came out to.
And then I have this thing that maybe my brain hasn't got enough RAM to so it's just like, oh, we'll just keep that one playing. Just the one that's playing in the background.
Yeah.
Oh my god. What sort of music were you listening to, like, and that, like, when you're at university?
I've never listened to much music, to be honest.
Wicked.
People don't usually say that, but no, I listened to. I was actually trying to write something about this, about how my mum and my brother and I, like, he's into music, but not as much as other people we know. None of us are as much as other people we know. But I would have been listening to, you know, when I was flitting, Radiohead and we used to go to parties and people played, for a point in time, people played the Smiths a lot at parties and things. And what else did we listen to? Jazz a lot too. But never being a real big music person, like, not compared to my friends who had extensive CD collections.
Because that's what I think is so cool about that very short story about the piano.
Oh yeah.
I just, and it just made me think of Morrison, because I was reading your work and thinking about Morrison. But that idea of pianos and piano teachers, and, you know, it's good for a child to learn an instrument. sort of idea.
Yeah.
So do you think you had a music equivalent, like, if people were having extensive music collections, what would you think that you were like equivalently interested in something like that, or
books probably.
I love that scene as well, where, you know, the eye that is you, that is the narrator, is looking through those books like everyone else at the fair is looking at other things.
Okay.
I love that. So great. Well, I think we've done our day.
Sure.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Really, it's been really interesting.
I don't know. Oh, man. I just love this book so much. I just wish everyone would read it.
Yeah.
I think you're right. I think you're totally right in that it is getting that. There was a while. I know when I was in Hawera the first time, people were probably, he was in living memory. Do you know what I mean? Like, him as a person was in living memory. And I know I talked to a couple of people and they were not incredibly, that's exaggerating, that he was not a person they wanted to talk about,
right?
And he was not a person, you know, that they, you know, thought deserved sort of talking about, but
right.
Yeah, and I think that that's changing, like,
yeah.
I think then the next time I went back, there was a cafe that had
Morrison's cafe.
Is it still there?
I think so.
Because, like, last time I was there was a couple of months ago, as we drove through on the naked bus. And we got to stop at the water tower and I bored my daughter really immensely going, oh, we're here. And she was like, okay. But, yeah, I just think, I think that you're right. I think it definitely feels like its time is here.
Yeah, I think it's in the Penguin Classics or whatever.
Oh, great.
You've got it.
Great.
Yeah, I've got it in there.
Because there are a lot of weird additions, eh? Like, I think, you know, like, it does seem like one of those places that was never fully, what's the word I'm looking for? It was kind of, like, handed around a bit, wasn't it? Like, because you've got the Angus and Robertson. Because that's a first edition, eh?
Yeah.
From the children's section.
From the children's section of the library. There you
go. Don't put your scarecrow in the children's section. That should be the theme of today's show.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, John.
No worries.
Thank you.